from Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! Muslims are continuing to stage protests around the world following the publication of cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad. We'll host a roundtable discussion on the controversy. Then, the anatomy of a story, the Bush National Guard story. We'll speak with Mary Mapes, the award-winning CBS News producer who broke it.
I lost my job after doing a story on the Bush National Guard connection, and Dan Rather lost his anchor position.
Truth and duty, the press, the president, and the privilege of power. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Pakistan, a suicide bomber targeted hundreds of people in the northwestern town of Hangu earlier today. The attack came at a gathering celebrating the Shiite Muslim holiday of Ashura. At least 22 people were killed, dozens injured. The attack set off an angry response, with angry Shiites burning shops and cars and clashing with local police. In Nepal, government forces are clashing with angry protesters calling for the ouster of King Gyanendra. He seized power in a widely criticized coup last year. The clashes come one day after most Nepali citizens observed a countrywide boycott of municipal elections that critics charge were an attempt by the king to legitimize his rule. In Kathmandu, police fired tear gas to disperse protesters gathered around the royal palace. The protesters chanted, "We don't want a murderer government. You can't kill people." In the United States, the Bush administration is back down under bipartisan pressure and agreed to brief congressional committees on some details of the warrantless domestic spying program. On Wednesday, White House officials briefed members of the House Intelligence Committee and said it would do the same for the Senate committee. Meanwhile, Republican Senator Arlen Specter said he's sponsoring a measure that would hand authority over the spy program to national security FISA courts. Specter said, quote, "The president should have all the tools he needs to fight terrorism, but we also want to maintain our civil liberties." In other news, recent emails from indicted lobbyist Jack Abramoff indicate his ties to the White House are far greater than President Bush has admitted to. Excerpts from the emails were published on thinkprogress.org. In one message to Kim Eisler, national editor of the Washingtonian magazine, Abramoff writes, he was personally invited to the Bush's Crawford Ranch for a fundraising event, but could not attend. At a January 26 news conference, President Bush said, "You know, I frankly don't even remember having my picture taken with the guy. I don't know him." But in the emails, Abramoff wrote, quote, "The guy saw me in almost a dozen settings and joked with me about a bunch of things, including details of my kids. Perhaps he's forgotten everything. Who knows?" Abramoff said. The New York Times is reporting authorities at the U.S. military prison at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, have resorted to a series of tough measures to force-feed hunger-striking detainees. Dozens of prisoners have held the fast to protest their prison conditions. The guards have strapped detainees into restraint chairs for hours and force-fed them with tubes down their throat. The Times says over the two dozen detainees quit their hunger strikes after, quote, having their feeding tubes inserted and removed so violently some bled or fainted. Thomas Wilner, a lawyer for several prisoners, said, quote, "It's clear the government has ended the hunger strike through the use of force and through the most brutal and inhumane types of treatment." The news comes as a new study based entirely on Pentagon data shows that of 500 Guantanamo prisoners whose cases were reviewed, fewer than half of them have been accused of committing violent acts against the United States or its allies. The study, carried out by lawyers for two of the prisoners, found the government has identified only 8% of the detainees as al-Qaeda fighters. Of the rest, the study found 40% have no connection with al-Qaeda at all, and 18% have no affiliation with either al-Qaeda or the Taliban. Meanwhile, 60% of the 500 prisoners have been detained, quote, merely because they're associated with a group or groups the U.S. government asserts are terrorist organizations. In other news, the Washington Post is reporting the World Trade Organization has ruled against a six-year European ban on genetically engineered crops, saying it violates international trade rules. The ban was challenged by the United States, Canada, and Argentina, and opposed by numerous farming and agricultural companies. Lori Wallach, director of Global Trade Watch, denounced the WTO for attempting to, quote, force Frankenfoods on the rest of the world, regardless of what consumers and their elected representatives say. Meanwhile, one of the world's most famous critics of corporate globalization and biotechnology, French farmer José Bové, was deported from the United States. He was detained last night by U.S. officials after flying into Kennedy Airport in New York, then sent back to France. It remains unclear why Bové was denied entry. We reached him just after he landed in Paris.
They kept me in the office during several hours, more than 8 hours, and they asked me questions about my activities, about the demonstration, our fight against the big companies, Monsanto, McDonald's, and all the fight on WTO. And they told me that if I was not allowed to come inside, and I said, because I'd been sentenced for this demonstration. I told them that I didn't understand that situation because since these demonstrations, I came several times in the United States.
José Bové was scheduled to speak at a conference in New York, put on in part by Cornell University and the Rockefeller Foundation, called Global Companies, Global Unions, Global Research, Global Campaigns. In 2002, Bové made international headlines when he helped to destroy a McDonald's under construction in France to protest trade policies that hurt small farmers. He's also been a leading opponent of genetically modified crops. This news on the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. The New York Times is reporting that of 135,000 requests for trailers that the Federal Emergency Management Agency has received from displaced families, slightly more than half have been filled. The news comes one day after FEMA ordered the evictions of thousands of people from government-paid hotel rooms. On Capitol Hill, over 200 people, including 9 senators, were evacuated from their office building Wednesday after a security sensor detected traces of a nerve agent. Later tests on the building proved negative. In military news, the Charleston Gazette is reporting a West Virginia soldier injured in a roadside bombing in Iraq has been forced to pay for the body armor that was removed from him while he was being treated. Last week, First Lieutenant William Eddie Rebrook IV was forced to pay $700 after he was told the Army had no record that the armor was taken from him. Rebrook said, quote, "If a soldier's stuff is hit by enemy fire, he shouldn't have to pay for it. There's a complete lack of empathy from senior officers who don't know what it's like to be a combat soldier on the ground." His mother, Becky Drumhiller, added, quote, "It's outrageous, ridiculous, and unconscionable. I wanted to stand on a street corner and yell through a megaphone about this," she said. And in Venezuela, President Hugo Chavez has lashed out at British Prime Minister Tony Blair after Blair suggested Chavez had failed to meet the rules of the international community.
En el Parlamento de Londres.
In the Parliament in London, Tony Blair made a call to Venezuela to respect the rules of the international community.
No sea sinvergüenza, señor Blair.
Don't be shameless, Mr. Blair. Don't be immoral, Mr. Blair, that you are one of those who has no morals. You, Mr. Blair, you are not one that has the morality to criticize anyone about respecting the rules of the international community.
The Venezuelan president went on to call Blair a pawn attempting to curry favor with President Bush, who Chavez called, quote, "Hitler, danger Bush, Hitler, the number one mass murderer and assassin that there is on this planet." Chavez went on to say, quote, "Go right to hell, Mr. Blair." And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers.
Before we move on with our first story, Juan, you wrote a very interesting piece in the New York Daily News about 6 soldiers coming home.
That story actually was about 2 years ago. But this week I wrote a story about the increasing illnesses among servicemen returning from Iraq. About 120,000, one of every 4 soldiers who have returned from Iraq or Afghanistan, have gone to VA hospitals, Veterans Health Administration hospitals, with a variety of illnesses. And the largest group, about 30%, have been diagnosed with mental disorders of one type or another, largely post-traumatic stress syndrome. And also, there is a huge number, about 35,000 of them, who have what the VA calls ill-defined illnesses. And if you recall, the soldiers that I reported about back in April of 2003, the returned National Guardsmen had all been classified with ill-defined illnesses. And it turned out when the Daily News did testing of them, 4 out of 9 had tested positive for exposure to depleted uranium from exploded U.S. shells. So the numbers, apparently, of ill-defined sicknesses that are of these soldiers are way higher than they are in the Persian Gulf War. And this is from, according to the Veterans Health Administration's own health utilization study that's been kept very quiet since it was issued in October. And I'm told that they're doing new studies that may indicate an even higher rate of soldiers in a more updated one. So we'll be trying to keep tabs of this story because there are definitely health problems, apparently, among the returning troops.
And we will link to your story at democracynow.org. Juan?
Well, Muslims are continuing to stage protests around the world following the publication of cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad. Earlier today, about 500,000 Muslims in Lebanon peacefully protested against the cartoons. In Afghanistan, police shot 4 protesters dead on Wednesday, bringing the death toll to 10 over the past 3 days. In the West Bank, demonstrators stormed the headquarters of international observers stationed in Hebron. Over the past week, protests have broken out in dozens of cities across Europe, the Middle East, and parts of Asia. In Washington, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice accused Syria and Iran of using the controversy to incite anti-West sentiment.
There are governments that have also used this opportunity to incite violence. I don't have any doubt that given the control of the Syrian government in Syria, given the control of the Iranian government, which, by the way, hasn't even hidden its hand in this, that Iran and Syria have gone out of their way to inflame sentiments and to use this to their own purposes. And the world ought to call them on it.
And on Wednesday, President Bush discussed the situation publicly for the first time during a public appearance with Jordan's King Abdullah.
We believe in a free press. We also recognize that with freedom comes responsibilities. With freedom comes the responsibility to be thoughtful about others. Finally, I have made it clear to His Majesty, and he made it clear to me, that we reject violence as a way to express discontent with what may be printed in the free press.
Meanwhile, the New York Times is reporting the outrage over the cartoons largely grew out of a meeting of the Organization of Islamic Conference held in Mecca in Saudi Arabia in December, 3 months after the cartoons first appeared in a Danish newspaper. Attending the summit were the leaders of the world's 57 Muslim nations.
The leaders issued a closing communique that expressed, quote, concern at rising hatred against Islam and Muslims and condemned the recent incident of desecration of the image of the Holy Prophet Muhammad in the media of certain countries. In Britain, Muslim leaders gathered on Wednesday to discuss their response to the printing of the cartoons. Sheikh Fiaz Siddiqui of the Muslim Action Committee compared the publication of the cartoons to Salman Rushdie's novel The Satanic Verses, which was banned by several Muslim nations for its depiction of the Prophet Muhammad.
It has to be said that there's been reports of a very deep offense that's been caused to the Muslim community, and there's been reports of deep anger and deep frustration that once again we have not learned the lessons of 16, 17 years ago when the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, was insulted by Salman Rushdie. And here we are again, back to square one again, insulting the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him.
On Monday, the Guardian of London revealed the Danish newspaper that first published the cartoons refused to run drawings lampooning Jesus Christ. In April 2003, a Danish illustrator submitted a series of cartoons dealing with the resurrection of Christ. He received an email back from the paper's editor, which said, quote, I don't think our readers will enjoy the drawings. As a matter of fact, I think that they will provoke an outcry. Therefore, I will not use them. Just before the program, we spoke with Jut Clausen, an associate professor of comparative politics at Brandeis University. Her most recent book is The Islamic Challenge, Politics and Religion in Western Europe. We reached her in Brussels, and I asked her to talk about the Danish newspaper that published the cartoons.
Yes, the paper is the country's largest newspaper, which means it has a circulation of about 175,000 copies. It is a conservative paper. It has a long tradition for association with the party of the of Anders Fogh Rasmussen, the Prime Minister of Denmark today. It has always taken into consideration the religious sensitivities of its readers, who are primarily provincial middle class and farmers.
And can you then talk about their decision to do this and what it meant in Denmark?
Well, there are different stories. One story is what they say. And then Flemming Rose, the editor of the paper, who was responsible for the cartoon, said that he was dissatisfied with the spreading self-censorship in Denmark on all matters related to Islam. And as examples, he gave that there were two theater performances, critical funny reviews over the summertime that had stories about George Bush, but none of them had any stories about Osama bin Laden. And you can ask, how funny is it to make a story about Osama bin Laden? But that was one of his examples of censorship. Another was that a children's book author had said that he couldn't find anybody to make illustrations for a book about the Prophet. However, that book is now out, and it does have an illustration of the Prophet on the front page, of the Prophet sitting on a winged horse. And the book is selling quite well, and no Muslims have actually purchased it because the drawing is quite mushy and nice. It is not a political caricature.
Yet the cartoon of Christ was turned down because it would not be appealing, the editor said.
Yes. And the cartoons about the paper published 12 cartoons. They were the result of what the editor called a competition. He said he wanted all he invited all Danish cartoonists to think about how they would portray the Prophet Muhammad. And only 12 came back, and he published those 12. And some of them are innocuous, and a few of them even can make you laugh, but some of them portray the Prophet in with a big bulbous nose and a blood-dripping sword, or with a halo that's broken into little horns. And they really stereotype Muslims as bloodthirsty sex maniacs.
And can you put the newspaper in the context of the politics of Denmark and also the politics of immigration, how immigrants are dealt with, particularly Muslim immigrants and Arab immigrants into Denmark right now?
Yeah, I think the best way of doing that is to describe what happened just the week before the cartoons were published. There was an annual meeting. One of the parties, it's a coalition government. Denmark has many parties, and no one party has enough votes to govern. So the government is a coalition of two parties, two right-wing parties, and they have they depend on the very xenophobic Danish People's Party for their majority. And at the annual meeting of one of the parties before the Culture Minister of Denmark, Brian Mikkelsen, said that in the past 5 years, he said, Denmark has been in a cultural war, and the government has now won the first round, and this is the time to start the second round to eliminate all signs of multiculturalist relativism in Denmark. It was a battle cry. The government has been deeply engaged in a project of Danish moral restoration, the definition of sharp definition of Danish values, which they say are Christian values. And the Danish People's Party stands, members of the People's Party, Danish People's Party, two of them are in fact pastors in the Lutheran Church, have repeatedly stood up in Parliament and said that Muslims are cancer on Danish society.
And so how do you think this decision to run these cartoons fits into that?
It's a political decision. They are political pals. It was a short-sighted decision. It was also an attempt to, fill time when the news is slow. I think that Fleming Rose, the editor, had no idea what would actually happen. He had a good idea that he would offend Muslims, but he thought that this was just a matter of domestic politics, and he didn't fully understand why these cartoons were so offensive to Muslims, and he certainly had no clue that they would lead to a cartoon war with Iran, which is what has happened now. And by the way, he has offered a helping hand to Iran in drawing cartoons depicting the Holocaust. So,
what do you mean? Iran put out in their national newspaper anyone who could come up with a cartoon of the Holocaust, they'd have a competition. And what is he doing in Denmark?
Well, he publicly announced that the paper, the Danish paper, Jyllands-Posten, will work together and be in assistance with the Iranians who want to draw the Holocaust, and that the paper will publish and print the Holocaust cartoons. It is a stunning decision, and one can only think that these people are completely out of their minds. But when I discuss, I teach at a Jewish university, and when I discuss the cartoons with my students, their immediate reaction was, if they can draw these kinds of cartoons about Muslims, what is there to prevent them from doing it about Jews? And obviously my students were onto something.
Jutta Clausen, Associate Professor of Comparative Politics at Brandeis University, speaking to us from Brussels. Her most recent book is called The Islamic Challenge, Politics and Religion in Western Europe. When we come back, a discussion about the controversy. Stay with us. Marcel Khalife here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. To discuss the cartoon controversy, we're joined in our studio by two guests. Behzad Yahmayan is an Iranian-born author living in the United States. He wrote the book Embracing the Infidel, Stories of Muslim Migrants on the Journey West, also professor at Ramapo College in New Jersey. And we're joined by Rahul Mahajan, editor of the website empirenotes.org and author of the book The New Crusade, America's War on Terrorism. He also wrote the book Full Spectrum Dominance. On the phone with us from Wyoming, we're joined by D. Reed Eckhart, managing editor of the Wyoming Tribune Eagle of Cheyenne. The paper has printed two of the cartoons on Tuesday and ran a third yesterday on Wednesday. And we welcome you all to Democracy Now! Let's start off with D. Reed Eckhart in Wyoming. Why have you chosen to print these cartoons?
Well, Amy, for us, it was simply a matter of wanting my readers to have access to material that I thought they needed to see. In a story like this, we can write about these cartoons all day long and describe them in as many words as we can find, but in the end, their ability to see them, I think, thought would help them to understand the issues. Certainly, we understood that they might be offensive to some, but I thought it was important for them to be able to understand the world and the issues going on in the world around them. Certainly, many of them could access them through the Internet, but many of our readers don't have access to the Internet, and I wanted them to be able to see them.
Rahul Mahajan, I'd like to ask you, these cartoons actually were published in September. This is months later that these protests have actually erupted around the world. Your reaction to, one, to the publication here of in the United States of a Wyoming newspaper, and also to the protests themselves?
Well, I think that the question of publication now and the question of the original publication are two different things. The problem with the first one was that some of the cartoons, in particular the one with the Prophet's turban as a bomb with Allahu Akbar written on it, were not just blasphemous if you're a Muslim, which shouldn't be of concern to those who are not Muslims, but were also racist, and they were essentially saying that all Muslims are terrorists. Now, if you reprint it, it kind of depends on what your point is. At this point, it is a huge story, and it is news, and people should be seeing it just to see what the controversy is about. Some people are reprinting it just to say, you know, another step in the culture wars, and I think that's silly. But certainly, even the original publication, you know, there is freedom of the press, and they had the right to do that. It was just a really bad idea and a very racist thing that should be opposed. The reason it's taken so long for the protest to come to a head is that that's how things always happen. Political processes do not happen overnight. This one had, first of all, there were, as was said already, there were many attempts to peacefully address the problem, most of which were rebuffed in Denmark. Then it got out to the attention of all the Muslim countries. Some governments and some groups in those countries decided to stir up protests. And then I think what really started this autocatalytic chain was the cascade of reprinting of the stories all over the place. So I think that that people say, you know, it's taken so many months to suggest there's something manufactured about this crisis. But no, that's just how things work politically.
Behzad Yahmaian, your response?
I agree with most of what he said. What I like to add to this is, like, the way the Western media has portrayed the Muslim population, especially those living in the West, has been very problematic. The reprinting of these cartoons, in my opinion, has been a political act with an intention of demonizing the Muslim population. That is, it was quite well calculated. It was anticipated that the most fundamentalist section of the Muslim population in the West would react, and then using that reaction as a way of the politics of exclusion, to excluding the Muslim migrants. There are 15 million Muslims living in the West, in Europe now. The Europeans are not happy with that. The aesthetics of their cities have changed. From the beginning, they were upset with having that many Muslims in their communities. The way the Muslims, some of them dress, the way they go out, the way they eat, the way their cultures, all of those have been troubling to a lot of the Europeans. This has now been used as a way of further excluding the Muslims. And also, it's important to note that those who protested this in Europe are a very small fraction of the 15 million Muslims who live in Europe. The majority of the Muslims are not against the ideas of Western democracy. They embrace that. That is why they are there. But the media actually blames and victimizes the majority because of the actions of the minority. So that's one problem. And in the end, it's going to lead to further marginalization of the large section of the Muslim population that wants to be a part of the European community and live there. But there's another problem that the media doesn't address, and that's really a main concern for me, that at the end of the day, a very prominent and important victim of this crisis is freedom of press in the Muslim world. That is, Muslim governments like the Islamic Republic of Iran, like the government of Syria, the government of Saudi Arabia, who have a long history of repressing free press. Iran is a number one country in terms of having prisoners who are journalists. Iran jails journalists, tortures them, kills them. Now, these governments have jumped on the bandwagon in defense of Prophet Muhammad and Islam. So in the end, anybody in these countries who in the future will defend democracy will be again cast aside, put in jail, in the context of, look, this is what democracy brings about.
D. Rita Eckhart, what about some of these issues what's happening in the European press really being not so much a battle over freedom of the press as a reflection of the ethnic and religious and racial conflicts within Europe?
Well, certainly Europe's a long way away from Cheyenne, Wyoming. We're a little 18,000 daily paper here in the American heartland. I think for us, not sort of steer the conversation in a different direction, but for us, this was real simply a matter of public access. We in America say over and over and again how much we believe in First Amendment and public access. Great newspapers like the New York Times, Washington Post, argue again and again for access for their readers to information. And now we have an issue that's particularly inflammatory, and everybody shuts up. That makes no sense to me. Are these cartoons racist? Perhaps. At the same time, I do think they probably represent a viewpoint of a number of people in the world. And I think my readers here in Cheyenne, Wyoming, needed to see that. I've certainly seen more inflammatory cartoons in the American press since 2001 than these. We looked at them very carefully before we chose to run them. But I'm not sure that simply labeling them as racist solves the problem. I don't think it's quite that simple. And I thought it was very, I think it's very important that the papers in this country publish them.
Would,
as you well know, the Associated Press won't even distribute them to its member newspapers. That concerns me.
Would you have published a cartoon that mocked Jews, say Jews with horns or Jesus Christ or that stereotyped African Americans?
I think under the right circumstances, we would. I've been an editorial page editor for a number of years at a number of newspapers. And when I lived in the South for 10 years, we ran a number of letters that were particularly repugnant, but we did it with the understanding or the hope that our readers would try to get a sense of what the world was going like around them. Certainly if there were embassies being burned or thousands turning out for protests, not to say that that's the heart of this, but a story of this size deserves, I believe, the attention that shows readers what's going on in the world around them.
And Iran's national newspaper has set up a competition for who can come up with the funniest cartoon about the Holocaust. Will you print those cartoons?
I think we would consider it. I think it's really important. Again, what's the world reaction going to be if there are thousands marching and embassies being burned and national protests going on? We think we would consider it, certainly.
We're talking to D. Reid Eckhart, who has printed these cartoons in his paper in Cheyenne, Wyoming. The vacation home, is that right, of Vice President Dick Cheney?
Well, the state certainly is. The other part of the state in Jackson, but yes.
And also the Muslim community. You have a small Muslim community in Cheyenne. What has been their response?
So far it's been quiet. We have a mosque here, about 50 members. We've not heard from them. I've heard from several readers who have expressed concern that we're sort of stirring up trouble. Our intention is to do a story in the next day or two, talking to members of that mosque and getting their response to the whole controversy as well as our publishing of the cartoons.
And Raul, what about this whole issue of the impact of this controversy on freedom of the press within the Muslim world? And also, is the coverage that is being given now to the demonstrations itself in itself helping to create images of less civilized activity within the Muslim world?
Well, I mean, I certainly agree with Behzad, and those governments that he referred to are always leaping at any opportunity to shut down any kind of dissent. And I must say that those papers in the Muslim world that reprinted those cartoons were taking a very different kind of stance, and it was a different sort of action than the European papers doing it. And whether you agree with it or not, and really, you know, obviously there is room for criticism of Islam or any other religion or any other belief system, but these cartoons are not a sensible way of doing it. They're meaningless. But even though if they couldn't find anything better, at least whatever else you say, they were taking a courageous stand, unlike, I think, the European papers. The question of, it's very interesting to see how these protests are being seized on and looked at, for example, by the right wing in the United States. They see this as a huge opportunity, much the same as some people saw 9/11 as a huge opportunity, although this time they don't even have to, there's no price involved whatsoever. And it's interesting that one thing that people are constantly referring to, for example, is you bring up this and talk about Muslim anger, and they say, well, what about the incredible incidents of anti-Semitic depictions in papers in the Muslim world? And that's true, and it's deplorable. But what's interesting is that the same people very often who talk about that and bring that up most are responsible for an incredible number of racist depictions of Arabs. Mr. Eckhart even said, for example, by his opinion, that there's been a lot more racist stuff after 9/11 in this country against Arabs, and that's true. If you look at right now at right-wing websites, there's one called Little Green Footballs, for example. They get over 100,000 viewers a day. It's a huge online right-wing community. They regularly print racist stuff. They regularly refer to all Muslims as Quranimals, an extremely racist term. And this is very common, and yet they are castigating Muslims for their anti-Semitism.
We heard the quote of Condoleezza Rice, Secretary of State, yesterday saying Iran and Syria are behind this. Yet we read in the New York Times today that this major meeting took place dealing with the cartoons and other issues in Mecca, in Saudi Arabia. Of course, Syria and Iran, that's being highlighted, are official enemies of the United States. The United States has classified them in that way. Saudi Arabia, a very close ally.
Well, you know, I mean, it's surprising that the Bush administration didn't try to pin Katrina on Syria and Iran. They're looking for everything they can to justify any kind of bellicose language or stances towards Syria and Iran. It's a lot more complicated than that. It's a lot bigger than that. And I should note that for the most part, Iran's response has been, while deplorable, I mean, I'm not a fan of mocking the Holocaust, has been in the same realm. It's been of trying to get other people to do cartoons and not primarily in terms of suborning violence. In Syria, it's different. Obviously, if the Syrian security forces cracked down, the mobs there wouldn't have been able to burn the embassies. And so clearly there's some level of complicity. And the reason for that, the reason it's different now than before 9/11, is that the whole Arab and Muslim world more and more see a West united in Bush's crusade. Even if they're not directly in Iraq, which Denmark is, you see them essentially in one way or another lending tacit support to a crusade that's already destroyed and occupied two Muslim countries.
And Behzad Yaghmayan, what does this controversy do in the battle within the Muslim world between more progressive-oriented and more fundamentalist political directions?
Well, this is a defeat, at least a momentary defeat, for the more progressive and secular forces within the Muslim world. And that is why I said that the democracy and progress in the Muslim world is one of the primary victims of this process. I speak about Iran more because I have a long history of knowing what has been happening in Iran with the question of freedom of press. Now, progressive forces that call for secularism, for the privatization of religion, for the separation of the church and the state are going to be on the defensive because there is a momentum against them. There is a momentum to show that Western democracy, freedom of press, will lead to blasphemy, will lead to the insult to religious views. So this has been very damaging. I also think this cartoon match is silly, it's damaging, and it's going to just ignite more crises. I hope it will stop. I hope less and less American and European journals will join this battle of cartoons.
It's interesting that the same groups of people are talking about freedom of the press, and that's very important to protect. And I'm talking about in European countries and in the United States, are passing laws against so-called hate speech or speech that is inciting violence, which is particularly targeting these very same communities.
Precisely. And this is also a sign of hypocrisy that the Muslim world looks at and said, look, they only do that to us. Another example of this, in the past couple of years, there has been debate across the European continent about the headscarf. And the French actually banned the wearing of headscarf. Isn't that a freedom of, I'm opposed to the headscarf from a different point of view, but I do not believe that the government can actually mandate body politics. So the Muslims are saying, on one hand, you have the freedom to do whatever you want in your press. On the other hand, we don't have the freedom to wear our headscarf because of our belief. So, and that causes more tension.
Do you think that there would also be less outcry if Arab voices, if Muslim voices were as much on the front pages being quoted in the daily discourse of politics as they are in the cartoon pages?
Precisely. It would have diffused the crisis. I mean, there are many things to do now that would perhaps help reducing this crisis in the future. One, the Western countries and the press must stop only looking at the Muslims as a source of fundamentalism. Unfortunately, we have fundamentalism in all religions. Fundamentalism has been on the rise. Look at the attack on the firebombing of abortion clinics in the United States. When the Last Temptation of Christ was shown in Paris, the theater was firebombed. We have fundamentalists ruling the White House now. So that needs to be addressed. Muslims don't have a monopoly of fundamentalism.
And finally, D. Reed Eckhart, are you calling for editors and newspapers around the country to follow your lead and publish these cartoons?
Yes. Well, I certainly would hope that more of them would. I understand the concerns on the other side, but I think this nation needs a good debate about what is appropriate here. I don't think it's quite as easy, and of course, we're a long way away from what's going on in Europe, but it disturbs me that only a few, a handful of newspapers have offered their readers an opportunity to see and have the discussion. Certainly the next few days and weeks, my readers will be having a talk about whether what we published was appropriate, whether it's accurate, whether it's concerning, whether it's racist. Without that kind of publication, without that kind of debate, where do we go? I think we would agree the founders of this nation certainly understood the need for speech and for repugnant speech to move this nation forward in many ways. If people can't see these cartoons, how do they know what they're really about? And I would argue that's not what this country's about.
Last question, and that's to Rahul Mahajan. Is this a clash of civilizations?
Well, yes, I think the battle has been joined. There is a clash of civilizations, but it's not because those civilizations had to inevitably come into a clash, and it's not because of irreconcilable differences. It's because there are people on both sides, but especially from the West, who want the clash of civilizations. It's here now. It's real. It's been building since 9/11, and it's going to be disastrous for all sides. The worst effects and the biggest victims will be people in the Muslim world, not just religious minorities, but anyone who believes in freedom in the Muslim world, who are suffering now from their own bigots and from a Western crusade.
Rahul Mahajan, Besat Yahmayan, and D. Reed Eckhart in Cheyenne, Wyoming. We want to thank you all for being with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Back in a minute.
Thank you.
The government has now banned the carrying of spears. Stop about every 1,000 miles in asking too much, is it?
You might wish to stay on and listen.
It was a place where everything was legal.
I met this woman.
So if you're looking for emotional satisfaction, my advice to you is seek professional help.
Thank you for joining us live on the air.
My pleasure.
One nation under God has turned into one nation under the influence of one drug. Television, the drug of a nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation on television. The drug of a nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation. TV, its satellite links are United States of unconsciousness. Apathetic, therapeutic, and extremely addictive. The methadone metronome, pumping out 150 channels 24 hours a day. You can flip through all of them, and still there's nothing worth watching. TV is a reason why less than 10% of our nation reads books daily. Why most people think Central America means Kansas. Socialism means un-American, and apartheid is a new headache remedy. Absorbed in its world, it's so hard to find us. It shapes our minds the most. Maybe the mother of our nation should remind us that we're sitting too close to the television, the drug of a nation.
Michael Franti, Television, Drug of a Nation. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 400 stations around the country. On Pacifica, NPR, Low Power FM, college and community radio stations, as well as on public access TV and PBS stations, and both TV satellite networks on Dish Network, Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV, Channel 375. And we are video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
We turn now to the story that brought down CBS evening anchor Dan Rather and prompted CBS to force out four of its top journalists. On September 8, 2004, the Wednesday edition of 60 Minutes aired a report critical of President Bush's service in the National Guard. In the report, Dan Rather charged that President Bush had received preferential treatment in the National Guard in the early 1970s and used as evidence copies of memos that had been provided to the network by a confidential source. Almost immediately, the validity of the memos and the credibility of the source came under attack. The source turned out to be retired Texas National Guard officer Bill Burkett. Initially, Dan Rather defended the story, but then 12 days later, Rather apologized on the national CBS Evening News broadcast for what he called a mistake in judgment.
Now, news about CBS News and the questions surrounding documents we aired on this broadcast and on the Wednesday edition of 60 Minutes on September 8th. The documents purported to show that George W. Bush received preferential treatment during his years in the Texas Air National Guard. At the time, CBS News and this reporter fully believed the documents were genuine. Tonight, after further investigation, we can no longer vouch for their authenticity.
On that same broadcast, Rather played an interview he'd conducted with Bill Burkett just days before.
Why did you mislead us?
Well, I didn't totally mislead you. I did mislead you on the one individual. You know, your staff pressured me to a point to reveal that source.
Well, we were trying to get the chain of possession.
I understand.
And
that.
You said you had received them from someone.
I understand.
And
that.
We did press you to say, well, you received them from someone, and that someone was whom. And it's true, we pressured you because it was a very important point for us.
And I simply threw out a name that was basically, it was, I guess, to get a little pressure off for a moment.
Have you forged anything?
No, sir.
Have you faked anything?
No, sir.
But you did mislead us. You
yes,
used
I
the word
it.
Lie. You,
yes,
you,
I did.
You lied to us. Why would I or anyone believe that you wouldn't mislead us about something else?
I could understand that question. I can't. That's going to have to be your judgment and anybody else's.
Burkett still insists the documents are real, but says he was in no position to verify them.
I also insisted when I sat down with your staff in the first face-to-face session, before I gave up any documents, I wanted to know what you were going to do with them. And I insisted that they be authenticated.
That was former CBS News anchor and correspondent Dan Rather interviewing Bill Burkett. Also in that broadcast, Rather announced that CBS was convening an independent panel to investigate the controversy and that the network would make the findings public. The investigation was headed up by the CEO of the Associated Press, Louis Bacardi, and former U.S. Attorney General Dick Thornburg, who had served in the presidential administrations of Ronald Reagan and George Bush Sr.
In January of last year, CBS released the findings of the investigation and promptly forced out four producers involved with the story, including the lead producer, Mary Mapes. Dan Rather resigned from his anchor position a few months later. Mary Mapes is a longtime TV news producer and reporter who worked for CBS for 15 years. In 2004, just a few months before the Texas National Guard story aired, she uncovered the photos of torture at Iraq's Abu Ghraib prison, bringing worldwide attention to the practices there. Mapes has always stood by the National Guard story and maintains the documents in question were never found to be false. She condemned the CBS investigation as politically biased and has said that she was fired because the chief executive of Viacom, which is the corporate parent of CBS, feared regulatory retaliation by the Bush administration. CBS maintains that Mary Mapes was fired because of faulty reporting. Mary Mapes has written a book about her experience. It's called Truth and Duty: The Press, the President, and the Privilege of Power. She joins us in our Firehouse studio. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Well, this is part one of our interview, but I'd like you to just lay out the anatomy of this story. How did you first learn about these documents?
Well, I've lived in Texas for 16 years, so this was a story that was sort of ongoing for me in a number of ways. For 5 years prior to airing the story in September 2004, I had been on and off of the Bush story quite a bit. It's very common knowledge in Texas what had been happening in the Texas National Guard. And the Texas Air National Guard during the 1960s and 70s was really not the crackerjack military outfit we think about when we think about National Guard units now. We have Guard units in Iraq now. At one point, I know about 40% of the troops in Iraq were National Guard and Reserve folks. This is a much different breed of cat than we had back in the 60s and 70s, where we sort of in Texas with the National Guard had units that really did not see active duty, that one person described to me as F troop with planes. And if you remember the old silly military show. But, I mean, there were good and valuable people there, but there was an awful lot of patronage and privilege that determined who got in and who got out. So this is very common knowledge in Texas. It's sort of the rest of the country, I think, that struggles with the reality of what happened there. So I knew this. I developed sources over a five-year period. We had looked at doing a story, talked about it a couple of other times, and always felt, or my bosses felt, we didn't have something new. You know, we didn't have something that put it over the top. When we ran the story in September 2004, I had two new things. I had the documents, and I had the first ever interview, sit-down interview with former Lieutenant Governor Ben Barnes. He'd never sat down in front of God and everybody in a TV camera and answered questions about what he'd done to get Bush in. So I had those things.
Explain who Ben Barnes was.
Ben Barnes was sort of a Texas political wunderkind. He became the Speaker of the House in, I think, 1966, when he was about 24 years old, Democrat, as all of Texas was at that time. But this was, Texans are, you know, not just political, they're realists. And so there was a lot of bipartisan back scratching and favoritism. And Barnes helped a number of people get into the Texas National Guard at that time, which was what was happening with the wealthy and the privileged and the well-connected. They were being funneled into safe guard units as opposed to going to Vietnam, where, you know, which was a war that was essentially fought by the young and the poor.
So when you finally, you'd been working on this for many months, and then what finally brought it together to cause you and 60 Minutes to decide to do a show on it?
Well, two things. One was Barnes agreeing to do the interview. The other was getting the documents. I would say early, in late spring probably of 2004, about in April, I read the Abu Ghraib story, and immediately after that I started hearing about documents that were floating around Texas. And you have to understand sort of the political grapevine in Texas, which is a wonder to behold, both Democrat and Republican. And the power of that grapevine. And there were reporters from really all over the country stampeding around Texas trying to get these documents. Vanity Fair had someone there. The New York Times was there. There were a number of freelance folks there. And I was there, and I wanted them. I felt that we'd put in the time, and I wanted, whether they were a political dirty trick that some genius had masterminded, I thought that was a fabulous story, too. Or if they were real, I thought it was a fascinating story. And I've always thought the Bush Guard story was really the Rosetta Stone of George W. Bush. It's who he is, what his character's about, how he came up, how he came to be, and what's at his core.
So how'd you hook up with Burkett?
Oh, in a roundabout way, through a number of different sources, and then finally talking directly and through intermediaries and convincing him to sit down and meet with us, and I had begged him to bring me an example. And Burkett had these, I believed, because he was a very likely person to get handed something. He was already in the public eye. He'd already come out against Bush. He had nothing to lose in the way that a new person might. And I thought he was a very likely source to get handed something by somebody. So it made sense to me in that way. I never did think Burkett had been the original source of the documents. I thought he was just an intermediary.
What did the documents say?
There were six pieces of paper. I got two the first day I met with Bush. They basically...
So you met with Burkett.
I'm sorry, yes, right. Bush really won't meet with me, I can tell you. Burkett gave me two that showed they were written by, purported to have been written by Lieutenant Colonel Jerry Killian. They were typed pieces of paper. Killian had been the head of the 147th Fighter Interceptor Squadron, known as the Champagne Unit, which is what Bush was assigned to in Houston in 1970. It showed that in 1972, when Bush had walked away from the Guard in April, that Killian had tried to get him back, had ordered him to take a physical, had worked with him to try to get him to show up for alternative guard duty, and then had been pressured, Killian had been pressured by his superiors to fill in paperwork that would get Bush off the hook for having been gone for a year and a half. So I thought they were tremendously provocative, very important, and I knew enough about the record to know where they fit in if they were real. I told Burkett when I first saw them that my greatest fear was that this was a political dirty trick, and I did it in part to see his reaction to my saying that, and I thought he looked shocked. I don't think he is a forger. And I also think if these documents were forged, they were done by a better forger than did the Niger documents.
Well, obviously, when you had the documents vetted by some experts, and afterwards there were questions as to whether those experts had actually said that they were originals or not. And walk through what happened with the experts when you first talked to them and then after the show broadcast.
As soon as I knew I had the documents, I had two documents to start with, and I got four a couple of days later, so I had a total of six. As soon as I found out I had the documents in my hot little hand, we started lining up document analysts. One of the first things I learned about document analysis is that it is a subjective sort of art/science. It's not DNA testing. You cannot look at a copy of a document, which is what these are, and determine absolute authenticity as to the date that these were typed. Now, an original document, you can actually do an ink DNA test and see when that ink was manufactured. I didn't have that option. So I had to have document analysts who would look at these things and say, yeah, the typeface looks right. You know, all the physical aspects of this document looked right. And then I had my own team that went through, vetted the documents for accuracy as to dates and names and personalities and, you know, when there was a reference to an Air Force manual paragraph and page, to go back and get the 1972 manual and make sure that that was exactly as it should be. And then I meshed them all with the official record. And I frankly thought I was going to find a point where they bumped up against each other and they didn't work. And it'd be clear to me that this was, you know, some craftsmanship on someone's part. And I couldn't find that. So I had two analysts, my most experienced analysts, telling me these are good to go. And these are people with more than 30 years experience. I had two other analysts who told me, one told me I need an original to make a judgment, and the other one believed she had some problems with it. And I went with the two more experienced analysts.
So you went with the story, Dan, rather than goes to the White House with these documents.
Right. Wednesday morning, the morning the story aired.
Does an interview.
Does an interview with Dan Bartlett.
Bartlett does not contest the documents.
No. Not at all.
What does he say?
He said that what I thought was wildly amusing at the time, and I stopped laughing about by the next day. He said that he believed that the documents fully supported Bush's contention that he had permission to go, because Killian, in these documents, was acknowledging that he had discussed with Bush that Bush wanted to go and work on a political campaign in Alabama. So he did not, and he was asked point blank whether he was contesting the authenticity, and he said, no, not at all. Then the White House put the documents, even prior to our story running, the White House put the documents up on their website, and I think that was a way of calling in the dogs, of getting political activists and operatives to, you know, get their powder dry, to get ready to start attacking him, which was what they did when the story aired that night.
When you say they put him up on their website, what reason did they give to suddenly put that up on the website?
Before your story ran.
Right. They didn't give a reason.
So you...
I mean, they certainly don't owe us any explanation. No. That's how they felt.
They didn't say they were fake.
No. They said these are documents that are going to be used in the story. But what I think it allowed them to do was to pass these documents on to operatives with no fingerprints, with no actual, you know, overt passing them on to someone specific.
So all hell breaks loose after the appeasers.
Yeah, in
that
fact,
night.
By the time our story was off the air on the West Coast, I mean, the moment it went off the air, it went nuts from attacks on the authenticity of the documents, typeface and proportional spacing and all kinds of stuff that no sane person would obsess themselves with.
But to show, talk about the authenticity of the documents,
right?
What
just
were the
to attack
the websites that went after you?
Little Green Footballs. I was just noticing Little Green Footballs is apparently a favorite today on this broadcast, because one of your previous guests had mentioned what he felt were racist postings. I was shocked at some of the postings on Little Green Footballs. Little Green Footballs is a very, very proactive, I think, far right. You know, I grew up on a farm with a lot of conservatives around me and good people who would never talk and attack this way. And I thought the attacks were vicious and pointed and sexist. And
Mary Mapes, this is part one of our two-day interview with you. Tomorrow we will find out what happened when the attack began and where CBS stood, and the investigation that was led by the former U.S. Attorney General Richard Thornburg. Mary Mapes is the author of Truth and Duty, The Press, The President, and The Privilege of Power, part two tomorrow. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Berkshire, Yehovdel Kadus, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Aaron Mate, Natty Harper. Our website is democracynow.org. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.